Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is educator and author Ira Raboy. Raboy earned a BA with a major in philosophy from the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor. He recently retired after 27 years as a teacher of English, philosophy, drama, history, karate, and psychology at the Lehman Alternative Community School, which is a public secondary school in Ithaca, New York. He also served in the Peace Corps and studied Zen and Japanese martial arts for 40 years. He just had an innovative and insightful new book published called Compassionate Critical Thinking: How Mindfulness, Creativity, Empathy, and Socratic Questioning Can Transform Teaching. It was published in September 2016 by Roman and Littlefield Publishers. And welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, nice to see you again.
Yeah.
You taught so many subjects for 27 years. So when did you decide that meditation and this kind of mindfulness would be good to introduce to your students and to teaching in general?
Well, it was gradual. Certainly the climate, even in Ithaca, was not one that I could just immediately just jump into doing the kinds of things that I do now or did at the last 10 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be something that gradually developed. There wasn't such an openness. Of course, right now, you know, the last 5 years, things have gone tremendously in the other direction.
Yeah, it's gotten complicated.
It's kind of complicated.
Yeah.
But when I first did mindfulness, actually the first time I did it was introducing it in a class. We were talking about different Asian philosophies. And that was my very first year teaching in Ithaca.
Wow.
And I thought that it was not good to just give philosophy or psychology, that you had to give some experience. So we did just a couple of times we meditated, and the students really liked it. Then from that, you can start talking about, you know, how the philosophy grows out of this experiential element.
Yeah, and how it can change your life,
right,
indeed.
Right,
and
that's
a major part of it. Now, in the foreword of your book, you talk about how real learning involves risk and that many students have become risk adverse. And we hear about it all the time on campuses. To talk to us a little bit about that, why do you think that has happened?
Well, risk adverse and anxious, you know, generally anxious, and I guess the two go together, right?
Yeah.
Fearful.
Yeah.
Well, it's a combination. It's a combination of the times. I don't know how much, but I'm sure that economic factors, political factors, you know, what's happening politically in the country now, certainly. But when I was teaching, this didn't happen yet, you know. But kids can sometimes sense insecurities in a culture and underlying things that we might not consciously know. And they, of course, didn't consciously know. Then there's also economics in terms of their future, and economics in terms of, like, the ones who want to go to college, you know, knowing how difficult that might be. So it's a combination of things.
Yeah, I keep thinking, because I've talked to so many people about some of these issues, that social media has something to do with it,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Constantly in touch, constantly, you know, wanting attention, needing it.
And it being the cultural norm that you should be constantly available, which decreases your own understanding of yourself, which makes, you know, mindfulness all the more important. I think it's kind of ridiculous for people to teach media and have it part of the school environment or even life home environment without teaching, well, what does yourself mean? What's going on in you?
Yeah.
So you don't get trapped by this media and media attention, and you don't do all these narcissistic kinds of things that you might regret later, or you might just miss what's going on in the world or miss what's going on in yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
The more you're not in touch with yourself, the more you're liable to feel bad.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of it is so superficial, but you don't realize that till it's caused damage in many ways.
Yeah.
Now talk to us about what mindfulness really means in the context of learning and teaching. Give us a little bit of a nutshell lesson on that.
Well, it's much more complex than some people think, and yet simple.
Yeah.
Because I always say, like, some of the instructions for doing mindfulness are really simple. But what's not simple, what's tremendously complex, is your mind. And so mindfulness is really learning how the mind works, how you as a person fit into your environment. So it's really becoming in touch of the reality of you. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of an experiment that you conduct on yourself to understand, well, how does my mind work? How do I fit in this world? How do I fit in with other people?
Yeah, so it has to do with self-reflection, insight, all those things that you talk about.
It's not self-reflection as people mainly think about it. Because people often think about self-reflection and is often taught, well, take your rational mind and think about what you did here or there. It's not that. In fact, to do that, I think you need mindfulness. Uh-huh. Mindfulness, I think, is something you need prior to self-reflection. And also, that's why I put it into critical thinking, prior to critical thinking, because you need to be able to be in touch with or notice moment by moment what's happening in your mind, what's happening in your body, you know, what your feelings are. And only if you really learn how to do that can you then reflect. Like in school, they're always asking, well, how do you think you did in this paper? Or how was your interaction with these other students? And how are you going to really answer that question if you're not in touch with your moment-by-moment reality?
So how does one get in touch with this then? I mean, how do you take a 14-year-old kid and teach them how to even get in touch with mindfulness? I mean, you have a lot of exercises that start with breathing, right? I mean, that's the beginning.
Yeah, right. You know, because breathing is your moment-by-moment life. Uh-huh. You know, sometimes students say, well, why bother with the breath? And I said, well, stop breathing and see how good that is, you know? And also, if you can get in touch with this basic element of life, your breath, then you switch it, you know, like teenage years, right? They're often looking for these gigantic, big things, the highs, in all kinds of ways. And they miss not the lows, but they miss the details. They miss the small things. And so they devalue them. So if you take them back to the breath, they start coming back to the small, the tiny, which is where we live.
So, you know what I wonder, though, with a 14-year-old, say, how do you stop them from becoming too self-absorbed? Well, you're talking about coming back to self and self. It has to relate to the outer world and the people around you, too.
Exactly.
Correct? Yeah.
But, you know, one of the, I just realized how to say this, one way to say this recently, because we think, you know, self-reflection is looking inwards, and then there's looking outwards, looking at the world. Mm-hmm. When you get too self-absorbed, you're doing self-reflection. But what really happens when you're self-absorbed? You see, that's the question you have to ask. What happens to you when you're self-absorbed? So mindfulness is actually observing. Well, not really observing, because that seems to be saying like you just look within. But you have to feel within. You have to notice with your entire being what's happening. And then you can break down moment by moment what's going on in you. And so mindfulness is actually coming to that first moment of awareness. Because why I say that it's not self-absorption is because when we're self-absorbed, we actually get into this, it's almost an intellectual thing, and we think it's not.
Mm-hmm.
What we're doing is we're creating ideas of ourselves, not the experience of ourselves. So mindfulness is neither self-absorption nor looking outside. It's the basis for both. It's getting you to the basis of both. So they say in a lot of mindfulness traditions that when you really see yourself, you see the world.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to write about this, and many people, certainly Buddhists and Taoists and others say, you know, your face is the face of the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so when you truly see yourself, you see the universe. There's no separation between you and other people in this very basic level of understanding and experiencing reality.
Yeah, this whole thing is very interesting. It seems to me it takes time to learn how to get in touch with a lot of this stuff, too. So I'm just wondering how you did this with students. And tell us how emotions affect learning. I mean, some of this is to try to help you control emotions and, you know, I mean, the primitive behaviors that can happen from emotions. Our brains are still,
right,
in part primitive. We know that.
Yeah. And so that's one of the things you got to realistically study in yourself. You can't stop studying yourself, right?
And so you have to tell the kids that, right? Because kids are even a little bit less in control of that primitive side of themselves.
But they don't like the word control. As you can imagine. And it gives them, sometimes they have the wrong understanding of what control means, because they think of control as being top down.
Mm.
But there's also bottom up control. Control that comes out of, like I was saying before, out of your ability to experience at the base level what's going on. Like when you have an emotion, right? The emotion begins by this impulse to just pay attention, to wake up. So it's like this initial energy surge. That's the beginning of any emotion. It's also the beginning of any movement or to some degree understanding of yourself. You have to find that initial energy. And then you start adding, you know, more intellectual things, right? And memories and other things. So then you start assessing what it means. First you pay attention. Then you see, is it dangerous, right? Then you see, is it pleasurable or not? And then you these basic assessments lead to, you know, do you turn away or do you go towards it? And then, you know, what actions to take and stuff.
So you are you in essence trying to teach people to just be quiet and sort of listen to the silence and whatever flowers from who you individually are will come out? I don't quite understand how this works, to tell you the truth.
Well, you're saying it beautifully, because that is what you're doing. In the book, I say, if your mind isn't quiet, how do you hear other people? You have to be silent to hear the world. It's like when you get quiet, there's a sense of satisfaction.
You mean calm too, don't you?
Yeah. When you get to that level of quiet, there's a sense of satisfaction and connection. You really feel yourself and you really feel the world and you really feel alive, and there's a subtle joy to it. Mm-hmm. So one of the things to get students to get into it, like you were asking before, is like to get them to feel that, because once they feel it, then they go, oh. You know, so I understand this. I like this, you know. And it's teaching students also, there's an intellectual component to that, and that is getting them to see that it's okay to enjoy themselves. Mm-hmm. And it's okay, then the next part to get to there, like when you go within, right? What first thing that happens to a lot of us, you know, I certainly, unfortunately, found this, is when you look within, you often get to judgments of yourself. Mm. And, you know, judgments often come out of the distance, right? So when you tell students, that's just a thought. It's not the entirety of reality. Look beyond that. That's what you, in some cases, it's something that somebody told you that you've believed. Mm-hmm. So look beyond this belief.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ira Raboy. We're talking about his new book, Compassionate Critical Thinking, How Mindfulness, Creativity, Empathy, and Socratic Questioning Can Transform Teaching. Now, in a lot of these lessons that you teach us in this book, you use music. To tell us how music helps to invoke some of these new ways of looking at the world.
Yeah, well, I use music, but I adjusted it. Not only what I used, but how I used it and how often, mostly how often, mm-hmm. by who the students were. Because what I realized, if you play like really calming music, like students are running through the hall, right? You got to get into this atmosphere, mm-hmm. of, you know, 300-400 people running through the hall together.
And then Stampede.
And they have very few minutes to go from one place to another. So there's anxiety, there's all these rushing, and then there's all the social things. I want to talk to this friend, I want to talk to that friend, I want to talk to this person. And then they come into a classroom and they're supposed to all of a sudden, you know, learn.
Yeah.
So you need a transition. And it's a transition, you have to have a transition that makes them feel safe, welcome, and turns them from fear to joy. So you play something that's sort of uplifting and calming. That's what I did. I didn't do it all the time, and I didn't do it in all the classes.
Yeah.
But certainly with the classes that I did mindfulness with, I did that. And then sometimes I played it, and sometimes I switched, but I would have music that was just for mindfulness, and then I'd have music that was just for when we did visualizations. So I'd have different music so that the students would, you know, sort of entrain to it, you know, it would help them get started.
Yeah, it seems to me it would help one focus and calm down if that's necessary.
And sometimes, you know, like music also gives them a barrier, allows them to create this little gap between the world outside in the hallway and those concerns with the reality right now in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So it gives them a separation. So sometimes when you're mindful, and we do mindfulness in school, and you're doing it, you're getting all quiet, and then you hear someone in the hall shouting.
So then you have to learn your lessons and imply them, right?
Right. And but so the music helps you let go of it. And you got to teach them how to also deal with distractions, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's something that people have to learn just to have any kind of creative endeavor in their adult lives. Now, let's focus in a little bit on compassionate critical thinking. I mean, that's part of this book. Obviously, it's
the hearts of it,
yes. So tell us about it. You say it's six types of practice can be included in this title.
Mm-hmm. Well, part of it is that you asked about emotion before. You know, like, it's emotional awareness and learning how to, the emotions are constructed by your response to things. So, like, when I was young, or even in college, I was taught that to think critically, I had to be non-emotional.
Ah.
But to be non-emotional, without emotion, you don't know how to make a decision. Without feeling, you can't see your way to doing things.
Mm-hmm.
So if you tell students to not feel or not be emotional, you're telling them not to be involved, not to be engaged. And if you're not engaged, who wants to learn? You get bored. You're not attentive. So that's one of the parts of it, of
compassionate critical
thinking. And then, of course, there's an interesting thing that one of my friends pointed out, like the almost dynamic and opposition between compassion and critical. Mm-hmm. That people automatically think about. I like to think about it as being dialectic,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's part of my process is to have this Socratic or dialectical element to thinking. So you go from figuring things out that rational. So you do this dialectic questioning of reality using your rational mind, and then you look at the same phenomena from a feeling point of view, like, how does it feel? How might someone else feel about this?
Can you give us an example of a subject that you could do that and switch back and forth?
You can do most anything.
Well, name something. So
well, you're looking at a character in a novel, one of the easiest ones, because novels are about human experience. So you say, well, okay, you got this character, and you look at her background. You look at all the rational and facts and context, historical and otherwise, of why she might do something. And then you go, okay, what is she feeling?
Mm.
And what do you feel about that? So it's not only you have to get into her place, so that gets to compassion, but you have to get into yourself. And what are you feeling?
You know, this almost sounds like when you teach acting to people.
Oh, yeah.
It sounds like drama, too. It sounds like some of the same exercises in trying to find the character that lives in the world and what is her inner life like. That's very interesting.
And then your understanding, going back to what we were talking about before, your understanding of your feeling and her feeling is a way to check up on your rational thinking. Because rational thinking is a powerful, beautiful thing. But as you know, rational thinking is sort of self-enhancing. Your rational mind can create this virtual reality very easily. And within that world, it can make total sense. But when it's comparing that world to other people's worlds or the bigger universe, it can be totally off.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to have many levels of checks on that.
See, that's where compassion comes in, too.
That's where compassion comes in,
where other people are, right? Other people's lives, even if you've never experienced them.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And compassion it's not just empathy. Empathy is, one, it's a cognitive element. Like, you can see what another person is doing and understand that on an intellectual level. And then there's the part of empathy that's feeling along with a person, mm-hmm. going in, stepping in their shoes, whatever. But then there's something more than that. There's caring.
Mm-hmm.
Caring about this other person, loving them. I like to talk about being kind.
Yeah, you use that. You talk about that quite a bit in some of your chapters, yeah.
So you get all these elements together, and then compassion comes in, and then compassion is not just thinking what is the right thing to do. It's almost like it's just there. Like, when you're really compassionate and you see someone in pain, you see someone suffering, you just do it.
Mm-hmm.
Or you see a character in a novel, you just do it. Or you're studying in history, a situation. If you learn how to do these compassion exercises and empathy exercises, then you place yourself in there.
So you have to get out of your intellect, right?
Exactly.
And
that's the going back and forth between the intellect. But you also, emotion can get confused. So you have to have the intellect. So you have to use both. And you have to go back and forth so that they check on each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that doesn't actually make more sense to me. Now, there's a huge issue going around university schools, and I think we can apply this, discussing hurtful topics.
Mm-hmm.
And kids always, you know, trigger warnings happening, looking for safe spaces. How do you apply this philosophy of compassionate critical thinking with discussing issues that are really hard for people?
Well, you know, there's a new thing that I fairly recently, it's just around 4 years ago that I ran into the discussion, the difference between how things like what you might call emotional contagion,
mm-hmm.
which is like you walk into a room and everybody feels sad and you automatically feel sad
yeah.
or angry and you pick up their anger and you're not aware of it. You just do it.
Yeah.
And then there's empathy where you have a little more awareness. You have the feeling part of empathy anyway. You have more awareness, but it might still wipe you out. Like a lot of teachers that I know, social workers, psychologists, they have so much empathy that they feel totally wiped out. And same with college or high school class or any class.
Mm-hmm.
You study a subject and you feel just so hurt and you go, it's just too much pain. And then people don't want to deal with it. They get burned out.
How do you apply this so that they can actually be open to it without it damaging them?
Well, you know, each of those things can have different elements going on. Like sometimes when you get burnout, you're feeling responsible. It's a sort of an ego thing, but not a bad ego. It's just painful.
mm-hmm.
So you're feeling, oh, maybe I caused this. I don't know about you, but I sometimes when I see someone who's angry, I feel, well, did I do something to cause that?
I actually don't go there.
Well, like I said, not everybody does it, but I know a lot of kids do. They walk in the classroom and they see you doing something and they say, oh, are you feeling bad? Are you feeling angry? As a teacher. And they feel, well, did I do that? Or a lot of students, like many years when I was teaching, half of my students or more had experiences where their families were broken.
Yeah.
You know, their parents.
Lots of families are broken.
Right.
So they feel responsible. Yeah, you have to get out of the victim syndrome.
That's right.
I mean, that's an entirely different subject. Don't you think
in some
ways?
But in a small part, that's what happens when you see this character and you get burnt out from it because you're feeling, oh, what is my part in that?
Ah.
Or you're feeling, I should be able to do something about that. And you're doing it from a distance. But when you get compassion, there's no distance in that sense. You're just feeling it's natural to be kind. It's not something that your ego or identity does. It's just the nature of the world to be kind. So when you start being kind, kindness replaces the other feelings.
Uh-huh. So you don't get as burned out.
That's right.
Kindness is a flowering inside you.
Yeah.
And instead of this, you know, hard thing that suddenly happens.
Right.
You
and you expand your sense of self.
Mm.
So it's not this person at a distance helping this other person at a distance. It's actually you helping you.
mm-hmm.
So you know there's a difference, but you're feeling for where it comes from is different.
Yeah. You talk about one of the other chambers of the heart of this book is the fact that the only way you can really feel compassion is if you feel compassion for yourself first.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to us about that. I mean, you have to teach that,
yeah.
especially to kids that are damaged, what we were talking about.
Yeah.
So many damaged families, so much violence, emotional blackmail, you know.
Yeah, no, no.
So how do you help kids reclaim a compassion for themselves? That's what's missing.
Right. You know, part of it is social awareness. This is the background. I'm not getting to the foreground yet.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the background, the Dalai Lama once said how much he was surprised by the lack of self-esteem, lack of empathy. And he said, like, in the United States, you almost have to be brave to care for yourself. He didn't say
exactly. He was talking about the U.S. culture,
yeah,
the culture
yeah.
here. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and when I say, when I think about, oh, I have to be brave to be, you know, in this culture. And then I say, well, what messages have you gotten? So this is development of social awareness and how other people and our culture affects you. That's at the background, the whole thing. And a lot of students, this is really potent. 1 year, we did this thing where, and it was in a psychology class, students felt that they couldn't feel good about themselves. It was just not allowed.
Really?
It was indulgent. It was superficial.
Well, why did they think that, though? It was because of what was happening in the culture, and they thought it was
They didn't have a reason for it. They just thought that was the way it was. It was just indulgent. It was just not permissible.
Wow.
It was not... So we did some ridiculous things. I did, you know, just to break it up, like we did play day, where they could be indulgent and return to being children. And then we got to that it's okay. This is a message, locating the messages that they had in themselves, you know, doing that through mindfulness exercises. Like one of the other practices that you asked about was called inquiry practices. Mm. So you ask them, well, what does it mean to you to be compassionate to yourself? You know, what memories come up? What images come up? So they become, they take hold of it, and then they go back to that. And then you get them to experience it and then get to the quiet in between the thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just sit in the quiet for a minute. And so they let go of the self-put-down. And then there's the other element, like part of it is this thing of fear of making mistakes.
Yeah. It seems to me people have to get in touch with the fact that they're human.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, that seems like the bottom line here.
But who knows what human means?
Well, of course. So you get it, you know, I mean, then that's a whole bunch of different colors and a kaleidoscope of things, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, but it seems like the bottom line.
Yeah. Being human means, on the one of the things it means is accepting that it's not that there are mistakes that you make, it's that you have to learn from your experiences. You can't expect an idea of yourself to be the reality of yourself. So you teach them even in meditating, right? Like you sit there and you meditate, no matter how good you are, you're going to run into times that you just lose it.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do then? That's the compassionate moment. That's the time when you really learn the most, is when you've lost yourself and then you realize you're lost and you come back.
Yeah, there's so many lessons in this. This is really a fascinating book. It's something that I'm going to continue to think about. Now, we're almost out of time. You know, you must apply these things to your own life. You've been teaching them for a long time. Is it something that you have to continuously work on, or does it become second nature, the ability to become mindful and to sit quietly? Do you have to continuously relearn it?
Yes. Mm. Yes and no. Because
mm-hmm.
what happens is your mind changes. You know, the whole getting into we're not getting into the neuroscience at all, but the whole thing that everything you do in your life affects your brain, changes your brain. So the more mindful you become, the more you practice mindfulness, the more you practice compassion, the more ready you are to look at the world, the more open you are, the more peaceful you are, the more you're congruent with silence.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, there's so much going on in the world, so you have to keep on developing it. So part of it is like mindfulness practice is really getting to the point of treating your life as you practice.
Ah, well, we will leave it at that. Thank you so much. Again, I've been talking to Ira Raboy. His book is called Compassionate Critical Thinking, How Mindfulness, Creativity, Empathy, and Socratic Questioning Can Transform Teaching. And I might add, it might transform your life, right? I
mean, right.
Thank you so much for joining us. Do you have any contact information?
Well, thank you so much. My website is just very simple, iraraboy.com, IRARABOIS.com. And the book, get it,
yes.
It's all over the place.
Yeah.
I hope you like it.
Thank you. Thank you, Ira.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outoboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.